It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The shopping mall started off as a uniquely American institution. You might have spent some of your childhood there. Cue a 1980s mall commercial.
Bayshore Mall has something special in your mailbox. 20% off coupons that you can redeem at any participating store Thursday through Sunday. The beach goes on with savings, fashion, food, and fun. Catch the
beach. It's a mall commercial from back in 1988. In some ways, the heyday of shopping malls. But malls faded in popularity over the years. There were too many of them. Big box stores added competition. Then internet shopping and the pandemic came along. But hold on, our next guest says malls aren't dead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you spend a lot of time in malls maybe during your childhood? Do you shop in them a lot in your adulthood? Do you have a story about a memorable time you had shopping or working at a mall? Is there a future for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra Lang is a design critic. Her writing has been published in places including Harvard Design Magazine, the New York Times, and the Atlantic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. Alexandra, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love that ad.
Now, you and I are roughly the same age. I won't reveal it to people, but I was a kid. I was a teenager in an era where going to the mall was just a thing you would do, not to buy anything necessarily. It was an attraction, and that was part of your growing up too.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in North Carolina, and what did you do when you wanted to meet your friends on a weekend afternoon? You went to the mall. Like, maybe you went to the movies, maybe you went to the food court, maybe you just walked around and looked at things. But that was the place to go. And I think that was true for basically millions of kids, especially those who grew up in the 80s and 90s.
Now, your book isn't just a trip through nostalgia, though. What led you to decide to study malls from, a design critic standpoint?
Well, I had read a lot of the stories about the death of the mall. But at the same time, I read other stories talking about, pretty famous architects like Renzo Piano designing new retail structures that seemed to me to be a mall. They weren't calling them malls, but they were definitely malls. And I wanted to delve into the history of shopping centers and malls and figure out why they were so popular and what was still good about them.
Now, there's one key figure, an immigrant design person responsible for the mall in its modern form, Victor Gruen. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. Can you tell us a bit about his role in the creation of what we think of as the mall?
Sure. It's Victor Gruen. That's right. He is really the father of the shopping mall. He was a Jewish emigre from Vienna. He fled the Nazis in 1938 and came to America. And he was somebody who started designing department stores and quickly realized that the new suburbs needed a place for people to go. They needed a new downtown. And the way that they were being built, there was no main street. And he thought, what if we can get the department store owners to move from downtown to these suburban areas and build a whole main street around their store? And the first shopping mall was built in Edina, Minnesota in 1956, and that's Southdale. And it basically has this central court that has climate control, it has daylighting, and it has a little Viennese-style cafe off to the side because he thought that's what Americans needed.
The idea was that, hey, this is in some ways a public space, but protected from the weather, accessible to people in this area. Talk about Victor Gruen's vision for what he hoped the mall would be.
Yeah, I mean, Southdale, some of the initial advertising trumpeted the fact that there would be 365 shopping days a year, because you know this in Wisconsin too. In the winter, nobody wants to go shopping outdoors. So the mall provided indoor year-round shopping, and it was also supposed to serve as kind of a community gathering space. Those initial malls especially often had sculpture, they had a carousel for the kids, they had cafes, and they basically had stores that would serve all of the needs of what was often the mother living in the suburbs who had to do a bunch of errands with kids tagging along. But he also felt like they should have a public role. Some of those early models had community rooms or churches, and people, in his view, just needed a place to come together.
You write that part of the appeal of malls in these suburban areas was it was a place where you wouldn't run into poor people on the streets. You wouldn't worry about the crime, say, in a downtown area. And in many suburbs with restrictive zoning laws, you wouldn't run into black people at a mall. This was not all a happy thing in some ways.
Right. That is definitely true. You know, malls are in some ways a manifestation of white flight from central cities. And many of the neighborhoods around the malls would have restrictions on who could buy the housing. So even if the malls weren't specifically designated as a white space, they would have been a white space because only white people lived around them. And because they are, in fact, private property, they could be regulated, maintained, et cetera, to kind of a higher standard and a more restricted standard than you would get in downtowns, which are actually public space.
Talking to Alexandra Lang about her new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have fond or less than fond memories of spending time at a mall? Did you go to them a lot in their heyday? Do you still go to your local community shopping mall? If not, what replaced it to meet your shopping needs? Do you miss anything about having a place with a, I don't know, big fountain in it and all the mall-like amenities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, malls were super successful, right, for a long time. Can you talk about malls at their peak?
Malls at their peak, they were building basically hundreds of malls per year because every suburb needed one. And during the time when they were at their peak, people did a lot of really kind of fun and innovative things with them. I think the innovation that most people are familiar with is the Mall of America, which put an entire roller coaster in the center of the mall, you know, no fountain, but a roller coaster. So there was this sense that malls had to kind of top themselves and that they were also competing in the fashion marketplace for the newer, better, you know, kind of more technologically advanced mall. And that's a really fun period to study, basically, you know, leading through the 80s and into the early 90s.
I listed a few causes of a decline for malls, and we've seen that in a lot of places around the country. One was, you write, they just built a lot of malls, maybe too many malls. How did we end up with a glut?
Well, the short answer to that is capitalism. Basically, mall developers saw where a mall had been successful but was maybe getting a little tired looking and just built a new mall 10 miles away in a fresher suburb and sucked all of the business from that older mall to the newer mall rather than building one in a place that hadn't had a mall. So then you get two malls, one's doing well, one's on a slow decline, and may eventually die. So I think that over competition and kind of lack of imagination and where to open new malls really doomed a lot of them.
Talking to Alexandra Lang, design critic. Her new book is Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. We're looking at malls past, present, and future. And yes, she says there is a future. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is in store for the future of American shopping malls? Maybe they look different now, laid out differently. We'll get into that in just a bit. Are you now or have you ever been a mall shopper or have you worked at malls? Do you have an experience you would like to share? Do you have a question about how they've changed over the years? And hey, do you have a mall that is unused or disused in your community? What would you like to see happen to it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about shopping malls, their history, their design, their future. Alexandra Lang is with us, design critic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you go to malls in your heyday? Did you make plans to meet someone by the fountain or the food court or you name it? Are malls part of the distant past for you or part of the present in how and where you shop? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, one key point I take away from your book is, yeah, we might keep saying malls are dead or dying. Malls are not dead, and they're not necessarily dying. Why? Make the case for us.
Well, some malls are dying, but even the most doomsday predictions by retail experts still indicate that there are probably going to be 700 to 800 healthy malls in the U.S., which still seems like a heck of a to me. Those malls tend to be like newer malls, malls with higher end department stores, and those have really held on to their customer base and are still offering something that people want. I think the dead mall narrative was really spurred by a lot of actually often very beautiful photography of dead malls that went viral, and people just kind of extrapolated from that and were like, okay, malls are over.
We heard from Ravana on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says they always hated the mall, but sometimes when they went to their local one, there was a survey company in it. Ravana learned to spot the surveyors to participate in surveys, be sure to walk by them so they could take a survey and get cash or coupons for the food court. Says made having to be in the mall a little better. I did a soda challenge at a mall one time. I intentionally picked the wrong one and I didn't get the free soda. I was just being ornery. But Alexandra, you know, that reminds me, like, the question of whether a mall is a public space. A survey company might set up shop there. Can protesters set up shop at a mall? Is this really a public sphere we can go into and interact with people? Has been a question over the years.
It has. And that the answer to that question actually varies state by state. The first legal case around whether a mall was public space and could be used for public protest actually occurred in 1968. And Thurgood Marshall wrote the opinion, the majority opinion, and said that malls should be available for protest because they were becoming the new main street. Now, over the years, that right has been whittled away, and now it really depends where you're located whether or not you can protest at the mall.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. KB is with us in La Crosse. KB, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
What did you want to tell us about?
Hey, I just wanted to mention I, in a previous life, worked in Rosedale Mall up in Roseville, Minnesota, and it was a blast. I actually loved that job because of the network of other employees and other shops. It got to the point where we'd all make friends with each other and stuff and offer each other our employee discounts, kind of like a whole barter system kind of thing. You know, I worked in a record shop and CDs and video games and stuff, and, you know, there'd be the girl down the hall who worked in a hair salon, and she'd do my hair, and I'd give her my employee discount for her CD that she wanted, you know, so David Bowie specifically, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's kind of cool.
KB, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. I worked at a mall for some years, and I got pretty good deals on some Sbarro's breadsticks, not going to lie. Alexandra, the people who work at malls, a community, KB says. I don't know if you'd looked at the mall workers that much, but it's a unique kind of place to work.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories like that, often from people that were hanging out at malls anyway as teens and then thought, hey, I should get a job here too. But I think that's a great kind of tribute to the fact that the mall can be a community space. Yes, we tend to focus more on the consumers, but having all of those businesses in proximity is part of what makes malls great. And the workers are really just taking advantage of the same kind of proximities as customers are.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Alexandra Lang. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Alexandra, maybe my favorite chapter was your last one. I think of malls as American. And not so much anymore. You surveyed some malls around the world, and they're kind of taking us to mall school.
They are. One of my favorite examples in that chapter is from the Philippines, where the malls are all basically the same size as the Mall of America. And they are very often on light rail lines. They will have government offices in them. They're basically like satellite cities all under one roof. And I think, especially if we're going to try to densify cities and inner ring suburbs, thinking of the mall as something that can truly be an urban hub is a great way to go. But it would require us sort of like opening our eyes to what's happening elsewhere in the world with malls.
And one interesting bit of motivation, I think it was Chile, you gave an example where if I own a mall, I can get a pretty good tax break if I host a museum or a library or other public institution.
Exactly. That is true in Chile. And actually, it's also true in the U.S. I got a message from a public library in Maryland that is located in the mall. They started as just a kind of like check-in, check-out mini branch, and the mall said, oh, you're doing so well, like, let's give you 30,000 square feet. And now it's one of the most popular branches in the county.
I want to look at some of the ways malls or the spaces they are on are changing. I've seen a lot of malls around the state here go from the all indoor enclosed to doing some redesign and, you know, having an outdoor street and you enter the buildings from outside. So outdoorizing these indoor malls. Is that a trend everywhere in the country?
That is a trend everywhere in the country. It's generally, you know, more popular in the South and in California, where the weather is nicer year-round. But that is definitely a trend. I also think, you know, something that's really important is there's been the demise of a lot of department stores. And so as malls try to reposition themselves, coming up with other uses for those department store spaces, things that people really do want to leave their house for, is super important. And some of the most important things in those categories that I've seen are food, you know, food halls, food marketplaces, and also kind of family fun like trampoline parks.
And another change that seems to be going on, well, grocery stores are part of malls more and more now, you write, but also malls, including on their grounds, residential stuff, maybe upstairs or maybe on the outskirts.
Yeah, a lot of people are suddenly realizing that malls have way too much parking. And what can we do with especially the parking lots around the edges of the malls, where maybe we want to start making nicer, more pedestrian streets? And those are really ripe for building housing, especially kind of townhouses, low-rise apartment buildings in places that really need to build more residential.
We heard from Charlie in Eau Claire, who couldn't stay on the line. Charlie grew up in the 70s. She says the name of the book is fantastic. Threw her right back into her childhood. Charlie remembers going to Hot Sam's and Orange Julius to eat with friends. Yeah, you when you started thinking, should I write a book about malls? People were very quick to share their mall memories with you, right?
Yeah, and as an architecture critic, like, I want to write about things, buildings, designs that people have feelings about. And so malls just felt like this great untapped resource that, oh, people love this architecture, even if they've never thought about it as architecture.
You mentioned untapped resources, and you write about malls that are more or less completely defunct, actually being potentially great opportunities to use that land, but in different ways. What kind of things are you seeing?
Well, one of my favorite examples is Austin Community College, their Highland campus in Texas, where an entire community college moved into a defunct mall, and they have built new residential housing in the parking lots. And they actually now have enough space so that they've invited the local public TV station to have their offices, you know, in one of the former department stores. And so it's becoming this whole mixed-use community and a center for students when before it was just this big dead mall.
What are you watching for? Now, I mentioned the glut of malls. There's also big box stores challenging them, internet shopping, the pandemic, and more. What are some of the big trends you're watching for now in 2022 when it comes to the malls you've been researching for so long?
I think The major trend is that kind of mixed-use redevelopment, saying, okay, like, we still want to have retail here. People, you know where it is, know what to shop for here. But what else can we do with the parking lot? What other kinds of things can we invite into this space, whether those are medical facilities or churches or kind of the upscale supermarkets that you can eat in, that will really bring people out of their houses and allow them to kind of get together in an air-conditioned space, a space with a fountain, a space maybe with indoor plants.
And one thing that struck me, it seems like nowadays mall, for people who are building malls, maybe a four-letter word. It seems like some of the people you want to talk to want to call their thing anything but mall.
That is so true. Let's see, what did they try to tell me? They called it a vertical retail center. They called it like a piazza. They called it a marketplace. But I just felt like people know what a mall is. Like when I say mall, you know what I'm talking about. And if I say vertical retail center, it's like, what?
Alexandra, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alexandra Lang is a design critic. She joins us today for a look at her new book. It's called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. Still time for you to share your mall memories, if any, whether they go back 3 decades or 3 minutes. Let us know what you think about malls, past, present, and future. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And hey, if you have a building that we would typically have called a mall in years past that's getting used differently now, where some of the space is getting used in a different way than straight up retail, love to hear about that too. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then perceptions about religion and politics in the U.S. don't always match reality. We'll talk to the author of a new book about church attendance, abortion, and we'll bust some myths along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. At the end of every week here on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get recipes, advice, and inspiration for baking and cooking with all kinds of ingredients. That's on the air each Friday, or you can check out our archives anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try out a recipe there and let us know how it goes. First, religion plays a big role in the United States. That's no secret. And religious beliefs can influence what we think about politics. One religious group might care a lot about specific political issues, or people of one faith might be more likely to support one party over another. But our next guest says there's a lot we get wrong about the way religion and politics come together, and we see those myths in the media and in public conversations. He says if you look at the data, there's a more complicated picture of how religion and politics relate than you might think. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're religious or not, is there something you think people get wrong about your faith or lack of same when it comes to politics? Is there anything you think people who think differently than you get wrong about those beliefs? Is there a conventional wisdom about religious politics you want to check with our guests on whether it's the real deal? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He's also a pastor at the First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, even before you started this book, you've taken on this role as a go-to person to check data and beliefs about religion and politics. How did you fall into that role?
I you know what? If you post 1,500 graphs a year for 3 years in a row about religion and politics, all of us, I call it the bat signal. I'll be like out with my kids somewhere, and I'll see a notification on my phone. Someone tagged me. Hey, Ryan Burge, can you check on this for me? And I'm like, I'm not on my computer right now. I can't look at the data. But people constantly try to bring me in on the scene to try to fact check other people's statements about religion and politics that they just don't think look right.
Before we dig into some specific myths, why is it important to get this right, to have a better understanding of religion and faith and politics?
Yeah, I just think, you know, that facts are the building blocks, are the foundation pieces of the way we understand the world. And if we, you know, can't agree on the facts, then we can't even agree on, you know, how to approach policy if we don't know what the problem is. If we don't know how big this religious group is or what that religious group believes or how they vote, how can we really interact with them in a social way? And the problem is, you know, if you look at the data, we asked Republicans to describe Democrats and Democrats to describe Republicans. They have a completely distorted view of each other. So we always kind of like other the other people out there in society, and we create a misconception in our mind, and we don't like that misconception very much when the reality is they're a lot more similar to you than you think they are. And once we get to that point, I think we have a lot more, you know, fruitful conversations and good dialogue. We really see each other for how we really are, not how we misperceive each other.
Now, you picked 20 myths here. How did you fall into picking the ones that you chose? What led you to use these as your examples of what we get wrong?
A lot of it was just, I may have a little note on my phone of like stuff I see on Twitter all the time. And I'm like, I need to go into that more. Like that's, I can't do 280 characters and get that and explain that whole thing. But the other thing that was going on in my mind was I wanted to make sure that I busted some myths that made conservatives kind of nervous, but also some myths that made liberals kind of nervous at the same time. Because, you know, being a mythbuster isn't just about making one party or one, you know, ideological viewpoint feel good. It's about trying to describe the world in an objective way, which means that sometimes the left's not going to be happy and sometimes the right's not going to be happy. And my job is to make everyone feel a little bit upset, but hopefully a lot more enlightened when they see what the data says.
We're talking to Ryan Burge about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If there's something that you know is wrong about how people talk about religion and politics, or if you're wondering, you want a little fact check, Ryan might be able to hook you up. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's get into some of your myths now, Ryan. One, the idea that young people become less religious during or after college. There's a de-religiousizing, if I can make up that word, experience that comes along with college. What does the data show?
Yeah, so there's this, that myth comes, I think largely there was a book or a movie came out called God's Not Dead about 10 years ago, where this evangelical student goes to a public university where there's an atheist philosophy professor. And the entire movie is kind of a conflict between him, the evangelical, and the atheist philosophy professor. The philosophy professor wants the kid to sign a pledge that says God's not dead. And if he doesn't sign it, he can't pass the class. So there's this constant like trope out there. If you send your kids away to college, they're going to leave, you know, perfect evangelicals or perfect, you know, Catholics, and they're going to come back Marxist, you know, quoting Nietzsche atheists. If you look at the data, kids who go to college are actually more likely to go to church than kids who don't go to college. And they're more likely to declare a religious affiliation than kids who don't go to college. If we look at young people, like 18 to 22 year old people today, about 40% of them who are going to college say they're atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. It's closer to 50% of 18 to 22 year olds who are not going to college right now. And there's actually other data that says that, you know, the more you expose kids to other religions actually strengthens their own personal faith that much more. So we really shouldn't be afraid of exposing people to other faiths. It actually makes them stronger.
Here's another one, non-denominational Christian churches. And I got to admit to this, as someone who, you know, talks about religion on the air sometimes and just thinks about it, reads about it, I think, okay, you divide up Christianity by, you know, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, you've got these well-defined denominations. Everybody's going to end up falling into a category. Well, not so much anymore. What's up with the rise of non-denominational Christianity?
Yeah, I think this is actually a great topic to talk about right now because the Southern Baptist Convention is meeting this week, and every reporter that does religion in America seems to be in Anaheim, California, covering that group, which is an important group. 13.5 million Americans are Southern Baptists. They're the largest Protestant denomination in America, But the share of Americans who are non-denominational Protestant is probably closer to 30 million Americans. So there's twice as many non-denominational Protestant Christians in America as there are Southern Baptists. In the 1970s, only 3% of Protestants said they're non-denominational. And now it's 25% of Protestants say they're non-denominational. And over the last 10 years, the only religious tradition, Christian tradition, that grew in America wasn't Baptists or Methodists or Lutherans or Presbyterians. It was non-denominational Protestant Christianity. And there's a future, I think, where there are more non-denominational Protestants there are not than denominational Protestants in the United States.
This means something. What does it mean?
Oh, I think it's a radical rethinking of American religion. Because if you think about what religion is, most denominations are very top-down, right? Whether the Catholic Church is obviously top-down, but also the Episcopalians, the United Methodists, and even at some level, the Southern Baptists do have a national structure that they kind of organize underneath. Non-denominational churches are, you know, they're bottom up, they're grassroots. And many of them were started by pastors who were not pastors at all. They were insurance salesmen or real estate agents or worked in a construction company or something like that. Start a Bible study in their basement. All of a sudden, 2 or 3 years later, they got 300 or 400 people in their church, and they really have no theological training at all. So, you know, we're really losing gatekeepers in American society. You know, there's no credentialing for these kind of groups. And so they all kind of they live independently of one another. And we really can't constrain them in any way. Like denominations used to kick pastors out who were, you know, saying unorthodox or heretical things. There's nobody to come in and kick these pastors out. If their church is growing, that's really all that matters to them.
Abortion has been in the news a lot lately with the leaked Supreme Court draft document, the final deal expected to come out any time now. Really, that's one of the myths you looked at, the idea that most Americans are really at one end of the abortion debate or the other.
Yeah, I think that's the one that it's so difficult to try to poll about abortion because people have contradictory opinions about abortion. There was this great study by Tricia Bruce at Notre Dame where she actually did long-form interviews with about 150 people about the topic of abortion. And she would ask them the same question in a different way at different points in the interview. And she would point out when they contradicted themselves, and they would kind of smile and laugh a little bit at themselves, go, I know I'm contradicting myself. Because people don't, most Americans don't have a clear black and white view on abortion. Even people who are very pro-choice, a lot of them have some trepidation, you know, in certain circumstances, like the government paying for it or late-term abortion or things like that. And even people who are pro-life, you know, they're not exactly against abortion in the case of, let's say, rape or incest or severe fetal defect or life of the mother, let's say. Most Americans are sort of in that pragmatic middle where they don't really find abortion palatable, but they understand that some people want to have an abortion and they don't want to restrict that right. So really what's going on with Roe versus Wade is we're trying to put people into far left or far right camps. And the majority of Americans are kind of in that mushy middle, and they really don't want, you know, abortion to be completely legal in every circumstance. They also don't want it to be completely illegal either.
We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, with us today to talk about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about religious affiliations in the U.S., how it fits into the political landscape? Do you have ideas or theories of your own? Is your community, you think, mischaracterized by other people, by the media, by politicians? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ryan Burge about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe even your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your faith community, whatever it might be, changing over the years, getting more political, less political, the people you talk to? Have you switched your faith community, the one you go to observances with, to church, to synagogue, you name it, because of politics for some reason? Or do you have a question just about some of the myths our guest is talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan, I've talked to you in the past about the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who say, yeah, I'm not really affiliated with any particular religion or atheism or agnosticism for that matter. And you write in this new book, there's a lot of misconceptions about them. And one of them is the idea that they are, you know, those numbers have been going up. That's true. But the idea that they're people who abandoned church for the most part or left a religious tradition. What do you see actually happening?
Yeah, that's something that a lot of evangelicals ask me about is why are people leaving church? And if you actually look at the data, more and more people are not leaving church. They were never raised with church in the first place. You know, for instance, we ask people in surveys, what was your religion growing up and what is your current religion? And, you know, the share of Americans who are raised without religion is going up every year. It's now over 20%. And what we're seeing is the share of people who are raised without religion, who stay with no religion as adults, used to be one third of them stayed nuns as adults. And now it's two thirds of them stay nuns as adults. So we're seeing more and more people entering adulthood. About one in three Americans now enters adulthood without a religious affiliation when it used to be less than 10% back in the 1970s. So it's not like people are leaving church, you know, at 25, 30, 35 years old. They never had a religious tradition to begin with, and they never really pick one up as they move into adulthood.
Another nun-related myth, again, N-O-N-E, is that the rise of unaffiliated people, religiously unaffiliated, means the country as a whole is generally getting less religious. What do you see actually happening?
I see religious polarization happening. So, you know, the people who are left now are the real true believers. And that's not just evangelicals. That's also conservative Catholics and, let's say, Orthodox Jews and Latter-day Saints and people like that. What we're really seeing in America is sort of the hollowing out of moderate religion in America. We used to have a tradition in America called the mainline tradition, which was about 30% of America in 1975 that are Episcopalians, United Methodist Church, United Church of Christ, folks like that. They were 30% of America in 1975. Now they're less than 10% of America today. Those used to be kind of the bridging churches where people from both political parties kind of, you know, sat side by side in the pews. And a lot of those people became nuns over time, or their kids are becoming, they were being raised with no religion. So now we're having a bunch of very, very religious people on the right side of the political spectrum and a whole bunch of nuns on the left side of the political spectrum. And really no one in that moderate middle that used to build bridges between the left and the right in America. It's just people on the far sides of the religious and political spectrum in America kind of shooting arrows at each other and yelling at each other and making and thinking the worst about the other side.
An interesting question that reminds me of, and this can generate debate, I think, in the evangelical world. A decent number of people that you and others have surveyed will identify themselves as evangelicals who go to church never or almost never. And then some of the evangelical people you talk to are like, whoa, hang on. You got to show up. How do you square that difference?
Yeah, I wrote a piece for the New York Times that really got a lot of, I think I'm going to, on my headstone, it's going to say Ryan Burge, the guy who talked about never attending evangelicals. but they're a growing force in American evangelicals. So about 40% of people who say they're evangelical on surveys say they attend church never or seldom, which means less than once a year they're going to church. 40% of evangelicals now attend church less than once a year. It was 27% in 2008. So what we're seeing is the word evangelical, which we've always thought is sort of a theological religious term, now in the minds of the average person seems to have sort of jumped the fence from that theological grounding and now has a cultural and political implication. And I think for a lot of Americans, they're seeing the word evangelical mean I'm very conservative, you know, politically, but I'm also aligned with Donald Trump, let's say. And we're seeing even non-evangelical groups, let's say, you know, there's a rising number of born again or evangelical Catholics now. About one in five Catholics say they're born again. So we're seeing a rise of these conservative Catholics calling themselves evangelical because they like the cultural cachet of what that word means when they really don't think a lot about evangelical, you know, theology or views of Jesus or anything like that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lou, hello.
Hi, guys. I just want to say that religion is a man-made construct. What we are more is spiritual. We're in touch more with the spirit side instead of the traditions and so forth.
And if I may ask you, Lou, if I were to survey you, how would you list yourself on a survey asking, you know, what religion do you identify with?
Right now I am none. I was an Episcopalian, not quite from cradle, but for quite many years. And I even discerned to go to seminary. But, the greater power led me on a different path. And I understand why now. I have a better understanding because I have a very good relationship with that greater power. And it's a very spiritual life now instead of religion. Like I say that, you know, it involves so many things that are directed by man, not by the spiritual realm.
Lou, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ryan, an interesting example of someone who puts herself in that nun category. I imagine this has got to be a category that's kind of hard to study, though, in some ways, because some people might have Lou's exact story. Some might have very different stories.
Yeah, what's interesting about Lou is she's actually telling a story I think is actually running rampant across American society, which is a move toward anti-institutionalism, right? She, you know, she even said it, like, I'm spiritual, but I don't like the institutions around religion. If you ask people on surveys, about 45% of Americans say they're very spiritual, but only 27% of people say they're very religious. Because I think for a lot of people, religion has a institutional component to it, a man-made component to it. They're still very, very religious. By the way, even amongst people who never attend church, they're more likely to say that God exists without any doubt than they are to say that God does not exist at all. So Americans have a stubborn belief in a higher power, even though they've sort of left institutional religion in droves over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. That doesn't mean their belief in God has gone anywhere. I think in actually some ways it's actually become stronger because it's become more about spirituality than religiosity, let's say.
Thanks for that call, Lou. We're talking to Ryan Burge. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. One more I wanted to get into, a very direct political tie. In the media, we often look at a candidate, say a presidential candidate's behavior and their expression of religion. Do they go to church? Do they quote scripture? Things like that. And assume that that is going to have an appeal to voters of a similar faith. Not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, the media's got to write stories for the presidential candidates for months leading up to the election. And, you know, religion's always a topic they want to kind of dig into. And when Joe Biden won the nomination for the Democrats, the whole narrative kind of switched to, I bet Joe Biden can win back some white Catholics that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. But if you look at the data, Joe Biden actually did worse with white Catholics at every attendance level in 2020 compared to how Hillary Clinton did with that same group in 2016. So, you know, the personal religiosity of a candidate, I think, matters very, very little. The most important thing when it comes to voting is the R behind their name or the D behind their name. That's really what guides almost all voting behavior in 2020 or 2022, where partisanship rules everything. And I think religion, I don't want to talk myself out of a job here, but religion has a subordinate role to partisanship in modern American life.
Another question that with the Southern Baptist Convention you mentioned going on now that you looked at is, okay, some evangelical traditions in particular, some Catholic, and of course the Catholic Church says no women preaching, no women in these official roles, running church services. What happens when you ask the members of those congregations what they think?
Yeah, people are blown away by this, but if you ask people, are you okay with a woman, given that she's qualified, you know, preaching behind the pulpit on a Sunday morning, you ask evangelicals that, and over 70% of them say they're fine with that, and it's over 70% of Roman Catholics are fine with a woman priest. So, you know, in the pews, there's not nearly this resistance to female pastors as there are, you know, from the hierarchical structures that exist in both those institutions, the Southern Baptist Convention and the Roman Catholic Church. Americans take very pragmatic views of things like that. And I've done all kinds of work on that data, trying to make that support drop, you know, looking, let's say, just at older men or, you know, people who believe the Bible is literally true. And it's almost impossible to find a group where support for women preaching goes below 60%. So there's a lot of widespread support in America, not just, you know, in American society generally, but even in conservative religious circles to allow women to have full access to all leadership roles that men have access to.
In our last couple minutes, what are some questions about religion and politics that you're still trying to figure out how to answer? Data can work for a lot of things. Sometimes it's hard to tease things out.
Oh, man. I mean, where do we start, Rob? There's so many things that keep me up at night. One is, you know, why the mainline collapsed. I brought them up earlier, right? The, you know, United Methodist Church, the Episcopal Church, they used to be these powerhouses in American society, American politics, and now they're really sort of marginalized in every single way. If people were sick of evangelicalism and the conservatism that goes along with that, why did they not leave and join a mainline church, which are much more moderate? They're LGBT affirming. They have female pastors. They're kind of progressive on social policy. A lot of evangelicals who are liberal should have left and gone to those churches, yet they left religion behind entirely. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That's one. Why did the mainline decline? The other one is, why are people leaving church? I mean, that's one that is like a $1 million question. The problem with that is it's really, really hard to answer those questions. So if I say, for instance, the average Southern Baptist is 20% more conservative today than the average Southern Baptist 30 years ago, The problem is those aren't the same people today as they were 30 years ago. That group's gotten smaller over the last 30 years. So is it the moderates and the liberals that left, or just the people there became more conservative over time? That's a really hard data problem to solve, because you have to use what's called panel data, which is where you ask the same people the same questions over a long period of time. It's really, really expensive. It's really, really cumbersome. And by the time you get that data back, I'll be in my 60s and won't want to write about it anymore. So that's just two of many, many that I think about at night, things I can't answer right now.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and a pastor in the American Baptist Church, with us today to talk about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@wpr.org. It's tomato season here in Wisconsin, and if you're growing them or buying them in large quantities, you might hit a point where you wonder what to do with them all. Once you've eaten lots of tomato sandwiches and pasta sauce and salsa, maybe even canned some, there might still be some overripe tomatoes left. Here's a good idea of what not to do with them, in my opinion. Hold a massive tomato fight. As reported by the Washington Post, the town of Buñol in Spain revived a tradition last week after a couple years off because of COVID of La Tomatina, a massive hour-long tomato fight featuring trucks full of overripe tomatoes. There are pictures featuring people drenched in pounds and pounds of pulped tomatoes. Some of them wear goggles. It draws tourists for some reason. A local tourism official said, quote, "We were really eager to resume our beloved party, to once again be able to throw tomatoes at each other and release all the adrenaline we built up these last 2 years." If you want to try this at home, leave me out. This is Central Time.